Welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and, incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You can also tune in the chat room if you please. We're broadcasting from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny South Pacific. Gosh dang, it's beautiful down here. Nice and sunny. And even Fukushima irradiated and everybody seems to have snapped up a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb to help the economy. I'm supposed to have a very special guest, John Perkins, the economic hitman on today. And our producer is just hooking that up in the background. So he's an economic hitman, and he's not bald with a tattoo of a barcode on the back of his head or anything of that nature. He's in fact somebody who's an economic hitman, and I wanted to ask him a few questions about John Key. Now, John Key, for those of you who are unfamiliar, maybe in the American or international audience, is the Prime Minister of New Zealand, otherwise known as Teflon John, otherwise known as Optimist Prime, who used to work for the Federal Reserve Bank in New York for 2 years as the, what was he head of? The European Bond and Derivatives Trade, if I remember correctly. He was Merrill Lynch's representative before they went bust, and John Key knew that they were going to go bust by the grace of something, and managed to get all of his shares bailed out of that particular area. So we have John Perkins on the line. I believe he's being connected right now. He should be answering the call any second. Wait for it, and there he is. John Perkins, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Can you? I'd like to ask you a quick question. Your job and the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, for those of you listening, available from www.johnperkins.org, illustrates a lot of your experience in working for American corporations where you would bribe leaders of nations in order to adopt debt-causing regimes and protocols. And I was just wondering, for your knowledge, I'm sorry to jump right into this without so much of an intro, but don't have you for a terribly long time. I don't want to waste a second. We have a current Prime Minister, John Key, who used to work for the Federal Reserve Bank in charge of European bond and derivatives trade. And when he came to New Zealand, I think in his first year, he started borrowing around about 400 million New Zealand dollars per week, according to a BNZ bank chief. Does that sound like an economic hitman to you, or a dictator that took a bribe, or is that just normal in today's leading economic malfeasance?
I think it's all of the above. Unfortunately, it seems to be quite normal, and it probably is. He's going to be well rewarded for doing that. If you call it a bribe, that implies that it's illegal, and it may not be illegal, and the rewards that he gets may not be illegal. There's so many legal ways to quote-unquote bribe people. I suspect that's what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you elucidate of some of your recent experience, and maybe relay this about your personal story about actually getting this so-called legal bribery, as you call it, going?
Yes, you know, it's when I was doing this, and I think it's there's a lot of commonalities today. You know, if we would make sure that the person that was helping us, and in this case, that means putting the country deep into debt, which also means basically that your country, that New Zealand, is selling its soul to the bankers, to those that's going into debt for. They'll strike a hard bargain at some point in the future. You can pretty much count on that. The person responsible for this, or the people, there's usually more than one responsible for this, get rewarded by various means, promises of great jobs in the future, of good consulting relationships in the future, if they're attorneys, that'll help their legal practice in the future. There's so many different ways to do this, depending on the individual and depending on the country that we're dealing with.
So in this particular part of the world, New Zealand, what do you think would be the protocol here? Because I see so much going on, financially speaking.
Well, I never worked in New Zealand, so I have to say that I like to speak from personal experience, and I don't have that in New Zealand, so it's kind of hard for me to say. But what do you think is going, your prime minister is going to do when he gets out of politics?
Well, I think he will probably do what our previous prime minister Mike Moore did, and get a what's it called? You become a representative overseas, like a governor general or a statesman or commissioner. That's what it is. You become a high commissioner of Monaco.
Exactly. Or you get a pretty lush job as a consultant with some major corporation or some major corporate conference group, you know, something like that. And tremendously well paid often in these situations. So, you know, that's unfortunately pretty common practice these days.
Mm-hmm. Now, incidentally, I've just received a message from one of my friends, completely unrelated to this interview, of a new film that you're in called American Empire, An Act of Collective Madness.
Mm. Well, I'm in a lot of films and a lot of documentaries I get interviewed for, and that's one of them, yeah.
They all just kind of blur into one, don't they?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What's really the good news about all this is that there's a lot of people making good films, writing good books, doing shows like what you're doing here that are really getting this message out. You know, I'm very hopeful that things are changing, that we're becoming aware. You know, you're asking these questions about your prime minister. You're aware of what's going on. And I want to ask you, what are these loans that he's agreed to being used for?
They're being used to pay off debt. So he's getting loans to pay off debt, and he's also selling assets that make a profit to pay off debt, and also signed us up to NATO and is now going to sign us up to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Right.
And there was there were huge cutbacks in social spending. I believe the Māori Law Office in Wellington was closed down. I believe at one point in the first year of his tenure, there were nearly two laws passed a day, most of which were cutbacks. And I can only think of maybe a couple of them off the top of my head, because there was just that many things being passed, the left, right, centre, all over the place, and the country doesn't seem to be getting any richer.
Yes, so it's the same old story. And what are the assets that he's selling off?
Power, hydroelectricity particularly.
Mm-hmm.
What else is he selling off?
And who did he sell hydroelectricity to?
I think they're going to be trying to sell them on the open market, maybe to the Chinese, maybe to American buyers.
Mm-hmm.
The selling off has not gone through, and it's not an entire sale either. It's what's known as partial privatization, where the government will retain 51% of the share packet, but no. And I think there's going to be a selected number of quasi-brokers in Parliament. I think they're not allowed to have any more than 10% of shareholding per person, but apparently you can shuffle them round so that one person can hold all of them at the same time, and you can sell the rest of it out from under the rest of them. It's a really complex sort of trickery, switcheroo type debacle, and I simply think that the entire country is going to be privatised. They've already privatised the largest city, Auckland, pretty much. It's under this new thing called the Super City. Nobody wanted it. Everybody said they didn't want it. And then the Minister of Local Government just rammed it through and just said, you're having it.
Yeah. Well, you see, Vinny, what this is all about is what I talk about in my books as being the corporatocracy taking over. So we really have a new global empire. It's not an American empire, it's not a Chinese empire, it's a corporate empire. And the privatization of these sorts of things the corporations end up owning them. And even if your government still owns 51%, the corporations will have the decision rights. So in essence, the corporations are calling the shots. And that's a global movement. It's been going on since I was an economic hitman in the 70s. It's gotten much, much bigger now. The stakes are much higher. It's huge. So it's really there is a new global empire. It's the first empire in the history of the world that's been created primarily without the military, primarily through economics. But these corporations do draw on the military when they need to, specifically the U.S. military and the secret services, the intelligence communities, the U.S., Europe, England, New Zealand, whoever they need to. The IMF, the World Bank are servants of the big corporations, and they're playing right into their hands. So,
well, John, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, which is our equivalent of the Federal Reserve, just got a new Reserve Bank governor who used to work for the World Bank.
Yeah. Well, of course. So what would you expect, you know? And it goes on and on. And you know, we're seeing that all over the world. When I was an economic hitman in the 70s, we were focused on what we call the third world countries or the developing countries, countries that had resources our corporations wanted. We use these techniques as a way of putting these countries deep into debt, and then we would force them to strike very, very lucrative deals for the big corporations, sell off their oil real cheap without any environmental or social regulations or restrictions, or their bauxite or whatever the resource happened to be, allow us to build military bases on their land to help protect those corporations, whatever was needed. But in recent years, that's expanded. You know, it hit Iceland really hard back in 2007, 2008, and 2005, 2006, 2007. And you know, Iceland did a very smart move. I was in Iceland shortly after they crashed, and I was going around the country trying to convince people to vote on a referendum not to repay their loan to the IMF and to the other big bankers. And in fact, they did that vote. They voted, no, we will not pay. And of course, everybody said, well, then you're going to be pariahs in the world economic community. That hasn't happened. And it didn't happen in Argentina or Brazil or Ecuador. All those countries refused to pay off some of their debts. And in fact, they're all much better off now. The president of the IMF was recently in Iceland, and I was just there about a month ago. And the president of the IMF was there praising Iceland for how it's now one of the strongest economies in what's called the European zone. And at the same time saying, but we got to address this debt problem. So ultimately, probably Iceland will end up negotiating a pretty good deal because they've got the leverage now. They may pay off some of the debt, but they'll restructure it. And I think New Zealand should take to take heed from this. This is a great example. The people of New Zealand need to stand up and say, no, damn it all, we didn't take on these loans. Our prime minister did and other political leaders did who are going to get well rewarded for it, and we're going to be left holding the debt, and by God, we're not going to pay it. You know, you bankers are at risk, and you know, you're going to have to live with your risk.
Well, it's essentially usury. You know, that's what interest on debt is at the end of the day, isn't it?
You know what?
Who would have thought that not submitting to usury would be beneficial for your economy?
Yeah, well, it's worse than usury, actually. It is usury, but it's usury that goes beyond that because it's enslavement. It's the modern form of enslavement. And when I decided to get out of this business in about 1980, one of the reasons I did so is I had this moment of enlightenment when I was sitting on the ruins of an old sugarcane plantation on St. John Island in the Virgin Islands. It was very idyllic. It was the sun was setting over the Caribbean. I was sitting up there with a six pack of beer. I know you folks in New Zealand don't drink beer, so I shouldn't.
Oh no, we drink beer like there's no tomorrow. In fact, for a lot of New Zealand drinkers, there literally is no tomorrow because of how much beer they drink.
I know it was a joke, but
anyway. Yes, so was mine.
So yeah, you gotta be careful what you say there. So mm-hmm. sitting up there with a six-pack of beer, looking out at the sun setting over the Caribbean, feeling very, very good about myself. And then suddenly I was struck by the fact that this sugarcane plantation had been built on the bones of thousands of slaves. And then I had to recognize that the whole hemisphere where I live is built on the bones of millions of slaves. And then I had to admit that I was a modern form of slaver, that what I was doing with debt was enslaving people. It's different from putting shackles around their wrists and dragging them out of jungles and putting them on slave ships. It's very different. But in the end, it has a similar impact in many respects. And we have to recognize that. And so when you in New Zealand agree to taking on these debts or you never did agree to take on the debts, but if you agree to pay them off, you're just continuing the process of putting yourself into slavery. Time to stand up to these slavers and say, no, hell no.
Well, you know, debt slavery is a big problem. Nobody denies it, because everybody who's got a student loan or a credit card debt or a personal loan or a car loan or any other kind of government loan or personal loan or any other form of that knows what it's like to have to work and have no money to show for it. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. John Perkins is my guest. We'll be right back after the break.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday
Welcome
night
back.
Is the night that we usually make love.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen.
Everything is just right. There's nothing.
It's Wednesday night in the United States, and it's never been a better night to make love with your prime sinister, who will indebt your country like a whole bunch of ropes and flax bushes all tied together that you'd throw over a cliff onto a fleeing mammoth that you plan to carve up and eat and feed your entire tribe for a winter.
Hello. Hi.
Sorry about the technical issues there. Anyway,
you were in the process of eating a woolly mammoth or something, I think.
Yes. That's what the woolly mammoth is really good for. You know, you capture it, you kill it. Takes the whole tribe to bring it down. But at the end of the day, it feeds you for a whole winter. And I think that's really what these bankers and scum are really trying to do. They're all trying to work together as a nice little team, as one, to make sure that they can feast on us for seasons to come.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we don't need to let them get away with it, though. We really don't.
How do we bring them to account? I understand the area that I'm kind of in and you're in is the public awareness side and getting the proper information out so that people can make decisions based upon reality rather than farce. The difficulty is it's usually the other people. It's usually the next generation that will wind up implementing all of the great things that people of previous generations really thought about. And you wonder just how much action can I personally take? Getting the information out is one thing, and I got accosted at a protest saying you're not doing enough.
Yeah. I get that a lot. You know, it's sort of ironic, you know, that I'll be on the speaking tour and somebody will, in questions and answers, stand up and say, well, why aren't you doing more? I'm like, well, what would you want me to do? Well, run for president or something. I'm like, well, that would be a total waste of time. But I think, you know, what we need to do, Vinny, we just have to keep getting the word out. And I think we are. It's happening. You mentioned earlier a film that I'm currently in. There's so much of that going on now. In fact, even Hollywood, you know, is coming out with mainstream films that expose the faults of the system. We're seeing uprisings throughout the Middle East and Latin America, even in Russia and China now, and the Occupy movement. And I really think that we're becoming aware. We're waking up big time. So I'm very, very hopeful Do things need to happen faster? Yes, I think they do. But on the other hand, I lectured a lot of universities and MBA programs, and 6 years ago, I found a very different attitude on campus than today. 6 years ago, students were looking to make money and get more power. Today, I hear constantly over and over, these students want to have children, and they want to make a better world for their children to grow up in. I really think it's happening. The transition is underway, and we need to keep pushing harder and harder. And thank God for the work that you're doing. You know, it's shows like yours, it's writers, it's all of us out there speaking out and doing whatever it is that our greatest passion tells us to do.
Well, I think it's kind of like there's already a flame that's lit, and people like us with the commentary and getting the idea and the reality out to people aren't the ones who started the fire. We're simply the ones pouring more fuel on it so that it gets bigger and encapsulates all of these, well, economic heretics in the middle who are so sociopathic, so narcissistic, so psychopathic that they do not even identify with the very human condition that we all claim to have and suffer from. Have you noticed that? The reason why people don't understand what these people are doing is because they're trying to think like this person thinks like me. They don't think like us. They don't even feel anything the same way as us right at the very top. And they get well-meaning, talented people who think that they're doing the right thing, getting in there to do their dirty work, and then eventually they wake up and go, oh my God, what have I done? And you have to live with the guilt.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I also think that we, the people, have to accept a lot of responsibility because let's face it, we've been sending a message. We do this very strongly in the United States, and I know you do it in New Zealand also. We've been sending a message saying, hey, you know, I want inexpensive but pretty well-made T-shirts and tennis shoes. And if they have to be made by slaves in sweatshops in Indonesia, I'll just look the other way. And I want cheap petroleum for my car. And if that if that means that the oil companies have to destroy the Amazon rainforest to get it, I'll just look the other way. We've been sending this message, we the people, and to a certain degree we're still sending it. But I think we're beginning to move beyond that. But we do have to recognize that, you know, we've made it very easy on the psychopaths who run the big corporations. Yes, there are psychopaths in those corporations, but we've made it easy for them, too.
Well, it's because we've all been kind of submissive and we want to do the right thing. And when you see a psychopath messing with your life, the general response is, I'm not going to work here anymore, and go out. And the psychopath persists to abuse somebody else that comes in to replace you.
Well, that's true, too. But again, I think we have to recognize the power that we have as consumers, and we do have to come together. There has to be a consumer revolt, but we have a lot of power. The marketplace is essentially a democracy if we choose to make it such. And, you know, back when I was probably your age, when I was in college, there was apartheid in South Africa. We boycotted the corporations that supported it. They got rid of it. We had terribly polluted rivers in the United States. We even had rivers that were on fire with pollution, and we forced corporations to clean them up. We forced them to open their doors wider to women and minorities. We've had tremendous success when we really clamped down on these corporations. But today, we don't seem to be doing a very good job at that, except on specific, some small issues. And what we really need to do is take a look at the corporations define their goal as a general rule, as being to maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. We need to tell these corporations that their goal needs to be make a return on investment that's generally going to attract investors, a decent return, 2 or 3% above inflation. But more than that, you've got to serve a public interest. The job of corporations should be to serve you and your listeners, Vinny, me and people around the world. It should be to serve the public good, and we need to insist that corporations do that.
Yeah, well, that's exactly how I run my show. Everybody who donates to me, I consider them not to be a donor. I consider them to be an employer. And when I've ever worked in the corporate world, I was a fracking good employee, except now I'm being employed by many, many people to do the right thing. instead of being employed by just one person to not do anything of consequence to make money.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And we need to convince corporations that they work for us. And they don't just work for that 1%. It's actually a lot less than 1% that owns them, that owns their stock. That's not who they work for. You know, any more than you work for the owners of your radio station, the people that own the equipment. You work for your public, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that. And corporations need to look at it the same way. They've got investors. They need to give those investors a decent rate of return, but they don't need to give them any more than that. They need to give us, the public, the consumer, the employees, the communities where they work, that's who they need to give their energy to, and we need to insist on that. And you know, in the United States, we have a precedent for that. The first 100 years we were a country.
John, you've kind of got this little scratchy stuff on your microphone or something.
Really? Still, is it still there?
No, it's gone.
Huh, I don't know what it was.
Sounds like somebody shuffling their feet or rubbing a microphone against a northern monk's beard or something.
Oh, well, pardon me, but I was scratching my microphone.
Ah.
Very bad habit. No, I was actually walking around. Now I'll stop. I'm not walking anymore. I'm sitting. So I don't know where I was, but so in the United States, we have this precedent of corporations couldn't get a charter for the first 100 years we were a country unless they proved they were going to serve a public interest. And then the charter lasted about 10 years, and after that they had to go back and prove they'd served a public interest, and we continue to do so. I think that needs to be a global policy, and we, the consumer, need to insist on that. We need to tell these corporations, hey, we're not going to buy from any corporation that isn't committed to serving a public interest.
There's also the other element of it, is that the corporations now own, in large part, the politicians/governments, and corporations by themselves can't force you to buy their products, but a corporation that is with the government can then pay the government thugs to force you to buy their products anyway.
Yeah, you're right.
You know? That's another thing that really irks me.
Yeah, and the corporations do own the governments. You know, nobody gets elected in most of our so-called democracies without huge funding from corporations and corporate support. And the politicians know that if they, when they leave office, they're going to get lucrative jobs working for the corporations. But again, we need to let these corporations know that that's just not acceptable. Or if they're going to control politicians, and they need to do it in a way, they need to send the message to politicians that they, the corporations, are serving us, the people.
So, the best way, I think, to make a system that makes the existing system obsolete is not to fix the existing system, but to push the reset button, as it were, and create a whole new one. If there was a new world and it had corporations that actually cared about people and took some form of responsibility, ethics, honesty, at the very least, you know, If they try their hardest, and if they do good work, and they don't hugely damage the environment or enslave their workers and treat them poorly, I don't think anybody should really be involved in their business, including the government. The problem is, that's an entrepreneurial thing, and entrepreneurs are dying out.
Mm-hmm.
Like the breed of people that are creative, who won't stop no matter what the deterrent, who force real technological and social changes in life. Everybody's become so dumbed down that those people are now even fewer in number. How can you revitalize that spirit? What kind of a system could bring that sort of mentality back?
Well, you know, in some areas, I think it's still pretty strong. If you look at, you know, a lot of the internet areas, and games and music and a lot that's going on there, it's still pretty strong. It's not strong in the retail business or the wholesale business. So, but we are moving into a much more technological time when things like that do happen. I just this morning was reading an article that said that basically the smartphone is replacing the automobile. Well, that's a fascinating concept. But the point was that young people today are not even that interested in getting driver's licenses because they already feel that they've got a lot of freedom. The automobile in my day
was your key to freedom. That was freedom. That's how you get freedom, by being able to drive, pick up your girlfriend, go wherever you wanted to go. But today, and that's how you communicated, but by being places. But today people are doing it through the internet, through cell phones, through texting. We really are entering a new world, and I think what we need to do is make sure that we protect that new world, make sure that there is no censorship of texting and of the internet, and really encourage stuff like that. Sorry, that's my cell phone.
Hey, we were just talking about how smartphones and everything keep you connected, even when you're live on air.
I know.
You gotta love that. And also, the best way, I think, that we can solve all these problems is give people direct access to the legislative process. You know, I would love it if legislation wasn't written in gobbledygook legalese so that the average person could really understand it and actually make submissions just on a smartphone. Da-da-da-da. Bugger officialdom, all right? The world's currently run by professionals. How's that working out for you? I think we need some amateur creativity, and I think we need some energy, and I think we need some people who are inexperienced and willing to develop the world in a way that they think actually works and experiment a little bit. Who the heck has got a rule book for how the world should work? Only psychopathic control freaks, that's who, and they're running it play by play. John Perkins, thank you very much for coming on the show today. I believe that that phone call for you might be for another interview that you've got scheduled coming up, right?
I think it is. You're right. And I apologize for ringing in your ear, but I'll go take that one now. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. You can check.
Keep up your good work, Vinny. You are what the hope of the future. And to know that there's a lot of others out there, too, that are like you, but you're the best.
Wow. Oh, my God. I just did a video about trying to control my ego. I think I might have to do another one.
I've enjoyed this immensely. I really have. So hopefully we'll talk again.
Yeah, man, let's have you on again sometime. Maybe we'll do an extended interview for a couple of hours or something if you'd be keen.
I'd love it. All right. Take care.
Cheers, John. Have a good day, mate.
You too. Bye-bye.
John Perkins, ladies and gentlemen, you can check out his, wow, johnperkins.com. Feeling a little bit woo from those comments there. I'm the best of them. Okay. Take it down a notch. Take it down a notch. You listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show.com. We'll be right back after the break. Join us in the chat room if you wish. Back in a few minutes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment of the first hour on the Vinny Eastwood Show here. Whew, just kind of got off the phone there with John Perkins, and he's made me feel quite perky. happiness. Talking with amazing people. Gosh dang, I love being a radio show host. And you know what's interesting? I wouldn't be able to do any of this, you know, talk to these amazing people and get such massive compliments. Without all this equipment, all of which has been donated. You know, I had a mainstream media dude named James Ireland from Fairfax Media, the local paper Western Leader, come around to interview me today just before the show, and stayed for the first 15 minutes of the John Perkins interview, take a few snapshots and left over the break. And I'll be bringing him on the show as well, because as a journalist, he's got quite a lot of background information and things like that, so I'm going to bring him on the show too. And all of these things, I was showing him around the office, and up on the walls I've got these John Key Not Wanted billboard things which were donated, and these big chemtrail banners that were donated, and a picture of a bee, I Tell the Truth to Sting the Bankster's Lies, that was painted to me, for me by one of my listeners. That's just the stuff on my walls. And in front of me, I've got the 27-inch beautiful iMac and this nice Yeti stereo microphone with four audio channels, two cameras on the desk, two megaphones, audio cables, studio lighting, seven or eight various terabyte hard drives, everything. Even the clothes that I'm wearing. This t-shirt that I'm wearing, it's got Elmer Fudd, and he says, "Shh, be very, very quiet. I'm exposing scumbaggery." That t-shirt, donated to me by a listener. The shorts that I'm wearing, I think they were hand-me-downs from Vapu Kupinger, who worked at Radio Wātea, who's kind of the first person to take me on as a co-host. I am conscious 100% of the time at the massive, massive contribution that the listeners give to this show. The guest suggestions, the comments, the emails and the compliments and the people who are all following me on Facebook, the thousands upon thousands of people that visit the website every month. It's just makes me feel a bliss, a peace, knowing that I'm doing the right thing, and for once in my life I'm not getting punished for it. I'm getting rewarded for it. You know, that was the only thing that I really didn't like about the corporate world or high school or university or any other of these establishment things that I've ever been part of, even being arrested by the police. You know, always tried to be honest, tried to be straightforward, tried to work harder and think better and be a better person and try and help other people out with their day and their jobs and things like that. Even the police, when I admitted everything, they still made up evidence against me when I got arrested. You know, it's just this total psychopathic system that I'm no longer a part of in many ways. I am cognizant of the fact that all these people who are donating all of this stuff so I can keep continuing to do this radio show are still stuck, many of them, in those kind of situations, you know, having to earn a living, working with some scumbag at a fracking slave job, dampening your creativity, rejecting your ideas, not advancing you properly, luring you in and with the promises of Christmas bonuses, and then you work harder for like about 3 months or something like that, and then they reveal that nobody's getting a bonus. This kind of carrot dangling BS that everybody's currently stuck in the middle of, it irks me, because I want to stop people from having to live that life. I don't know if I'll ever be able to employ people. I would love to be able to do that. Somebody, there's bound to be people out there right now who are willing to kind of drop everything and just start their own radio shows, start their own YouTube channels, just like I did. And my advice is, don't wait, you know? Start doing the right thing, even a little bit, even if it's not perfect, even if it appears very amateur. Just start doing something, and if you really, really commit, like really commit, if you want to live 4 years of total abject poverty, not even being able to buy yourself so much as a cup of coffee because you're so broke for that many years, you can do all this as well. It is not for everybody. It really isn't. I do the job that a lot of people cannot do, and I think that's why people donate. Is because there really ain't anybody else doing things the way that I'm doing, nobody else is me, essentially. This is what I was born to do. And that's why I'm happy, because I'm doing what I'm meant to be doing. I'm being who I was born to be. And I'm so grateful, so excruciatingly grateful, for all you people listening who simply give me the ability to be who I am. Sure, some of you might criticize me or tell me to do things a little differently. That's okay. I actually prefer that to people who say nothing at all. You are so valuable to me. And that's why I need even more support, because still broke over Christmas. It's a real harsh reality. And if you can, if you've got that that spark, you know, I'm going to support Vinny this time. Vinny needs a few donations. Vinny needs $5 a month on a subscription fee. Hey, I've got a credit card. I've got a PayPal account. I've got a few spare bucks or something. I'll give it to Vinny. You know, this is surprising how many people do that. And then with just such a handful of different people from all over the world giving me a little bit of resources so that I can use just to pay the rent, pay the bills and that kind of thing. I just keep doing what I'm doing. That's what the majority of people tell me when they donate to me. Vinny, just keep doing what you're doing. I don't know how you do it, but just keep doing it because I really enjoy the shows. I've been woken up. I've had remarkable insights. I am impressed with the quality, etc., etc., etc. These kind of compliments make me keep going, mentally speaking, and the donations themselves help me keep going, fiscally speaking. I think this is a new business model that I've kind of pioneered, which very few other people, in fact, nobody else has been able to accomplish this as yet, just have a radio show and a YouTube channel and be able to draw enough support from the community that consumes that content to be able to survive. Just survive is almost impossible. Without years and years of groundwork being laid, relationships forged, umpteen different activists, even the people of New Zealand have no radio show on mainstream media, anything like this. No alternative media or anything like this at all. You know, getting John Perkins on, the economic hitman, I have not seen that on Radio Live or National Radio or any of the other tunes and streams that you might be able to listen into. This is the place where you can get that information. And it's all free for everybody. You don't even have to donate. You don't even have to subscribe. There's plenty of other ways to contribute that are non-financial in nature. Simply emailing a link to an interview to a person, you never know what their little stone that is thrown into the little puddle of somebody's mind. You don't know what the ripple effect will be. Keep on keeping on. That's my philosophy. I ain't dead yet. So I'm going to keep working really, really hard until such a time as I'm just no longer breathing. That's the commitment I've decided to make. We need media, don't we? Media that can be trusted, media that aren't soulless and vacuous and talk about things that just don't matter. You know, when people are screaming 9/11 was an inside job behind some kind of news reporter in New York who's just interviewing girls about how fracking exposing their dresses were, you understand right then with the contrast of who the real media actually is. It is not the giant offices. It is not the huge broadcasting studios. It is the people who are usually at home working along on the internet or cruising out to protest and taking a little bit of footage or a little bit of audio recording equipment. And just with that tiny little amount of resources that they have accessible to them, they are now replacing and beating the mainstream media at their own game. Their advertisers are going down in the mainstream media. They're firing staff all over the place. Australia just closed down two printing presses for Fairfax Media or something like that. A lot of the newspapers are now going digital because they can't even afford to print out those cheap newspapers anymore. I remember seeing that newspapers used to be like about 80 cents in New Zealand. Now they're like $1.60 or something. They've doubled in price and barely anybody wants to even read them anymore. And when you go into the archives of Auckland Library, like me and my friend Penny Bright have done, you see article after article after article after article demonizing, disinforming, disingenuous, absolutely cum-lucky scumbags who are just propagating BS. It's just that simple. If you want the truth to be out there, you have to take some form of responsibility for it. Either the responsibility to be the media in your particular area, or the responsibility to support the media in any area that you think really warrants your support. Are they doing the right thing? Are they genuine? Are they happy? Are they making your life and the lives of others better by the very work that they do? In this case of the show, yes, I really am. And I want to do more. And I need your support to continue. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate today. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com.
The virus, alert the masses.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest for today, in the second hour, is a man named Kendall Carver. Kendall, welcome to the program.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Vinnie.
No, it really is mine. You've got a fabulous webcam going there. Nice, beautiful quality. And the topic that we're going to be talking about today, based on your website, internationalcruisevictims.org. Could you give us a brief rundown about what you're all about?
Well, I don't know if I can make it brief, but I'll start off and tell you how we got into this and et cetera.
You could make it boxes or brief.
Okay. Well, we had a 40-year-old daughter. I have four daughters, and this daughter lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And in August of 2004, her daughter called and said our daughter was not returning her phone calls. So we didn't think there was any problem, but I said I'll check it out. And we called the Cambridge police. After about a week, they went into her apartment. Everything was fine, but no daughter. So that started a path that's taken us literally around the world. I mean, it's been an incredible journey. The Cambridge police, after about 3 weeks, traced a credit card transaction to a celebrity cruise line. So I called them, and I said, gee, was our daughter on your cruise? And they got back in a couple of days, Vinny, and said, well, she was, but after a couple of days didn't use her room, but that's not uncommon. They couldn't tell us whether or not they got off. And we said, well, gee, is there any video or anything? Anybody talk to her? And they said, you got here too late. It's 3 weeks. We've already erased the videos. And we just decided we could not leave it at that point, Vinny. So we made a decision, a simple decision. We wanted to speak to one person on that ship that had seen our daughter, and that was the steward, obviously, who reported Marion missing. We hired an international detective agency, Kroll & Associates. We put a law firm in Boston on retainer so we could take legal control and started a process. And eventually, in November, the detectives tried to get to the steward, and they said he'd made no report, and there was nothing, no information. So they made a decision to go on the boat. So the detectives went on the boat again. They wouldn't let him speak to anybody. They said there'd been no review of video concerning our daughter, and they had no information. So then, Benny, we're now into November. She disappeared in August. We took court action, first in Massachusetts. Then we had to hire another law firm in Miami. And finally, we issued a court order to depose the steward. That was like in January 16th of 2005. To get to that steward, Vinny, cost us $75,000 because the cruise lines were doing everything they could to cover it up and saying there was no video, no problem. Well, when we got into the deposition and got to the steward, he, to my amazement, said that he'd reported our daughter missing daily for 5 days to his boss. His boss told him, forget it and do his job. Just forget about it. Then at the end of the cruise,
something tells me his boss was on the take.
Well, who knows what was going in his mind? And then
I've had a look into lots of kidnapping and human trafficking and things like that. And usually there's a network set up where an apex where the authority figure that you would go to for help usually would be either a judge or a police officer, or on a ship would probably be a captain. And they become a conduit for offshore interests where they will be exporting these people, selling them into sex slavery, things like that, and prevent any investigation from those that they have authority over.
Well, absolutely. But what we, this journey, that was just the beginning. That was the worst day of my life in January when I realized that they had been lying to us from the very beginning concerning our daughter, that there were no reports. So we started a process of getting material, and we eventually came up with papers, Vinny. Emails, which can be found on our internet site, showing where in the third week of September, they were setting up the cover-up of our daughter's disappearance. They literally were setting up the cover-up. They interviewed the steward and said, don't tell this to anybody. They'd gone to 15 people that he worked with, say, make sure that no calls get to this guy. And they discussed disposing of her items. Well, let me get back. I want to jump ahead a little bit, Vinny. I told you in the deposition, the question was asked, what about the videos? And the answer, their lawyer interrupted and says, well, we'll count that as privileged information for national security reasons. What's national security reasons having to do with our daughter disappearing? In June of 2006, and I'm really jumping ahead, we met with the president of Celebrity Cruise Lines at his request, and he said, the tape was broke. So we had it. It was erased. National security reasons. The tape was broke. Guess what, Vinny? 2008, they admitted they had a video. They'd kept it for several months and reviewed it.
And you know, that sounds like to me, it sounds like the CIA is involved in the human trafficking.
Well, people go on cruise ships and think they're safe. And in fact, they're not safe. In June of 2005, after months of investigation and spending, a book came out called Devil in the Deep Blue Sea. So it was written up in Business Week here in the United States, so I went and I bought the book, and I got to a section, again, which is on our website on my congressional testimony, saying cover-up of crimes is a standard operating procedure on a cruise ship. They get the person, the steward or the supervisor at this point, off the ship, and that's just the way they do business. And when I read that, Vinny, I realized that's exactly what had happened to us. You know, so all of a sudden I realized, my goodness, we're not alone. We're just part of a bigger story. And so after 14 months, Vinny, we decided to go public. Now that's, you know, if somebody disappears 14 months ago and it isn't public, you know, that's a big job. Well, guess what? I knew one guy in New York City. I served as CEO of an insurance company in New York City for 18 years. And I knew one person was CNN. I called him like in September and he was doing Katrina with a guy named Anderson Cooper. I'm sure you know Anderson Cooper. And I talked to him in September about Marion, and you know, he kind of brushed me off and said they were busy and, you know, probably wouldn't get back to me. Well, he called me in October and said, Ken, we're going to come out and we're going to film this story. And that put us on the first Anderson Cooper show in the country. And the first Anderson Cooper show that he ever had. And he also did something else fitting. They said, Ken, call Congressman Chris Shea, who's from Connecticut, where we'd live. He has an interest in this subject. So we did, and that put us into the first congressional hearings in December of 2005. First time ever this subject had been brought to a congressional hearing. And at that hearing, Vinny, I came to the conclusion from our own experience, from reading this book and from the cover-up we faced and this hearing that crime on cruise ship was a major international problem. I didn't realize the scope of it, but I came to that conclusion. So if you have a question, interrupt me. But we then got four other...
I kind of do, but...
Yep.
it's just... You think about the globe-trotting aspect of it. So you go from this country's jurisdiction to that country's jurisdiction, and with each one that you change, with each port that you enter, you have a different law, and in between then you're operating under the law of the sea, you know, admiralty law, in other words. And
it
appears that what about when they get into international waters, you know, and what the legal kind of loopholes are there, but reason I'm talking about this, I was just wondering, I wonder if there's any drug shipping going on within these things. You know, they've got plenty of passengers on board. They've all got plenty of luggage. I'm not sure if they're all scanned and sniffed by dogs as they're going on. Maybe some people see too much.
If you go to our website today, you'll find a story we posted in the last week about finding tons of drugs in one of the cruise ship terminals here in the United States. Sure, it's being moved.
Well, the people who move large quantities of drugs are the CIA. The only people who do it.
I will say this, Vinny, at this point. The cruise lines have been very successful in building a relationship with the people that should be regulating them. And that includes the FBI and the Coast Guard. Every 2 months, they host a dinner for them. And I've told them, we've had many meetings with them, that's a conflict of interest. The cruise lines paid, because they flag their ships in third world countries. Carnival is based in Panama. Royal Caribbean is based in Liberia. They flag their ships...
Yeah, well, that's because the regulations on seaworthiness in Liberia and Panama are so lax that that's actually what a lot of international shipping does, because it's very expensive to maintain ships in a US or New Zealand level of standard. And in fact, there was a ship that crashed off the coast of New Zealand, our worst oil spill ever, and that was flagged in Liberia but owned by somebody in the Philippines. It's a big scam that's going around the maritime industry right now.
You know, Vinny, I couldn't agree with you more on that. They've done that so that they don't have to follow work rules. They can get people from third world countries who work literally for nothing. And they're on those boats 7 days a week for months. And as a result of that, crimes occur. There's an interesting report done by somebody in New Zealand. And it's called Sex at Sea, Sexual Crimes. Here it is. And it's a Jill, Poulston. She is the School of Hospitality and Tourism in Auckland, New Zealand. And the sexual crime rate on cruise ships is 50 to 70% greater than in the average American city. And most of the crimes are committed by crew members who are from third countries. And nobody's convicted of the crimes.
Mm. Well... Have you ever heard the expression, the fox guarding the hen house? Who do you go to complain about a person on a cruise ship sexually violating you, but to another employee of the cruise ship?
Yeah. Well, and the cruise ships, Vinny, and this came out in our investigation of Mary and a very critical information. Cruise ships, people don't realize this, take the legal position. They do not investigate crimes. They're under no obligation to investigate crimes. So that leaves you with a jurisdiction of wherever they flag that ship, who clearly does nothing.
Well, you know how on some airliners they have an air marshal with a gun or something of that nature? Do they have sea marshals, you know, people with mustaches and parrots and such?
There should be independent security on those cruise ships, independent of the cruise lines who have the authority. Now, we actually have on our website how that can be set up with Interpol. I mean, a cruise ship, Vinny, is a city with thousands of people. And they have the cooks, the people that do the cleaning, they have the restaurant employees. And all the people involved in the ship, the captain is like the mayor of the city. The one thing they don't have, Vinny, is any police force that has any authority.
And they've got a fire department.
Yeah, well, hopefully. But the police, the security on a cruise ship works for the cruise ship. So if you got half the crimes being committed by crew members, they're not going to do anything because the cruise ship is liable.
If I may, a cruise ship is a floating corporatocracy city.
Correct. It's a city with no police. Now, what city in New Zealand or wherever you are, if you had 500 policemen or 500 people, they would have a policeman with independent security. And if a crime occurred, they would take action. That doesn't happen on a cruise ship. It's a void, and people do not realize it. And what's the setting of a cruise ship? Royal Caribbean, Carnival, they're all starting to do it. Unlimited drinks for one price. You know, you got several thousand strangers. You have crew members from third world countries. And it's a recipe for disaster. If somebody went to New Zealand and said, I want to open a resort, I'm going to staff it with third world people. When you walk in the door, we're going to lock the door. You can't go out. And if a crime occurs, we're not going to call the police. They wouldn't let them go in business. Yet that's exactly what a cruise ship is.
Hmm. You ever noticed how massive societies who don't have any police are usually run by cartels or gangs?
Well, I don't know who runs them, but clearly they have so structured these vacations that these cruise ships that it's for maximum profit. It's not to protect the people. It's to sell gambling, unlimited drinks. And unlimited drinks is a recipe for disaster, Vinny, with no police.
You're speaking to somebody from New Zealand. All right. I think it's something like 95% of all weekend crime in New Zealand is caused by alcohol.
Absolutely. You know?
So you're thinking about, have you noticed people who are alcohol-fueled? That given that statistic, it creates a propensity for crime. Whereas you take somebody who's using cannabis, marijuana, for example, if they're going out into international waters, why don't they have an unlimited dope kiosk or something like that? You know how many crimes would be committed other than the smoking of the pot itself? None, because everybody would be too tired. And it's like, yeah, should we rape this person or kidnap them? Nah, man, let's just have another J.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you buy the unlimited drink pass packages that they're now promoting on these cruise lines, you'd have to be drunk to get the number of drinks that it's cost you for the unlimited package. They'd all be drunk. I mean, it's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Yeah, and that's, I don't want to help it makes money.
I mean, they'll give you the cruise to get you on it because it's the alcohol and those things are selling.
Well, you know what? It's kind of like Hansel and Gretel being enticed inside the old witch's candy house with a little bit of candy. We'll be right back.
Look at me, driving and I won't stop.
Welcome
and it
back.
Feels so good to be alive and on top.
My feels good to be above water.
My tower,
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show, and I was talking with my very special guest, Kendall Carver, otherwise known as Ken Carver. It sounds like a nice tropical drink, actually.
You know, mate, can you rustle us up a couple of Ken Carvers? Yeah, sweet, mate. You get real messed up on that with your unlimited alcohol.
And, you know, his website, internationalcruisevictims.org. You're speaking over the break, and being familiar as I am with direct testimony from researchers, activists, investigators, former insiders, things of that nature, you see certain aspects pop out at you when Ken tells me this story of the cruise ships having people disappear and then covering up the process having enormous amounts of crime. Also, what would be depicted as recipes for madness, like unlimited alcohol and what have you. In fact, that reminds me of Soviet Russia. That's what the Russian Secret Service and KGB was really all about, bringing all these well-informed, intellectual people that they love from other countries who are leaders in their fields, whether they be doctors or lawyers or politicians or whatever, and just get them drunk and keep them drunk the whole freaking time, so that by the time they leave Russia, they're red on the inside, and they love it. So what we're talking about here, in terms of the drug trafficking, which we've just elucidated on, a number of tons of drugs being smuggled on board a cruise ship, this ain't somebody mixing up a few ecstasy tablets in his little lab cooking it at home. This is somebody with a huge quantity of drugs to shift. And if they've caught one, you can be guaranteed it's happening fracking everywhere. That reminds me of the CIA's operation in Afghanistan. After the United States invaded Afghanistan, poppy production was previously about 1% of the global market. And I think within a year, it had grown 4,000%, and now it's about 90% of the market. And I've had testimony from soldiers, New Zealand and Australia, a few US soldiers too. People have been photographed guarding the poppy fields and guarding these massive containers that are stacked from floor to roof with harvested poppies, which CIA contractors come in and fly away and sell on the open market. And in terms of the people disappearing and crimes happening, there's connections there. I see the same methodology that Child Protective Services in the United States, or CIFS, Child, Youth and Family Service in New Zealand, used to cover up their kidnappings and child rapes and sexual assaults and things of that nature, because they'll have a police officer who's on the take, a doctor who's on the take, a nurse who's on the take, and a psychiatrist who's on the take, and a judge who's on the take. Who are all the people that you would go to for help if somebody kidnapped your child? Either a nurse, a doctor, a judge, or or a police officer, wouldn't you think? They're on the take. And they cover up for each and every one. It's a perfect system. And lastly, is human trafficking, which I believe DynCorp, aren't they the makers of America's voting machines? How funny is that? Has been exposed for trafficking humans. And we're not talking about small amounts of them. We're talking about tens of thousands conservatively, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people that they're trafficking around. Sex slavery, sweatshop slavery, or snuff film props. You know what I'm saying? This real sick, horrific stuff doesn't get anywhere in terms of people trying to take them to court a lot of the time. And if it does, most people will not be informed about it, because these scum that run all this crap also control the media. But despite all of the scumbaggery and its very eclectic and incredible majesty, usually small quantities of people who are dedicated to the cause always win out against these fracks and always expose them. And that's exactly what Ken's been doing in terms of the cruise ship industry here. And you've had quite a lot of successes, Ken, so you tell me. And I'd like you to actually reveal to the audience, just since you started this, where have you gotten to so far?
Well, I tell you, we started off January 1st, 2006, which is not that long ago, with four families. And here we are in 2012. We now have friends and victims in 24 countries in the world. Hundreds of people have come to us. And tremendous talent has come to us. And you know who else has come to us, Vinny? The press. The press has been, we have no money. We're victims. Nobody's paid anything. But the press, when they look at the story, can only come down on one side of the story, and that's on the side of the victims. And this year in Australia, 60 Minutes of Australia came over here and did a terrific show, which was played. It's on our homepage. Dateline of Australia came all the way over and did a show. And as a result of that kind of press, and we have a famous case in Australia, for the first time, the courts, the legislature in Australia is now holding hearings about passing laws to start to control cruise ship crime. They've had a couple of hearings after the first of the year. They'll be holding more hearings. Our people will be testifying. And this little group of victims, the first time we ever testified as victims was in March of 2006. And at that hearing, we did something that nobody thought we would do. Instead of just having six victims tell their tragic story of being raped or losing daughters or whatever, we came up with a simple 10-point program, like background checks of the employees, keeping videos, just simple stuff. And the cruise lines will say safety is our number one concern. That's their opening statement is safety is our number one concern. Well, if it is, then that says there's nothing they won't do.
Well, you know what? I think they're actually telling you the truth. Safety is their concern, just not yours.
Oh, okay. Well, that's probably true. So anyway, we came up with a simple 10-point program. And at that meeting, I went up. I appeared at a congressional hearing, the first of four hearings that I ended up testifying at. And I appeared at this hearing, and there was a guy that ran the Cruise Line Association. I went up to him. His name was Michael Crane. I said, Michael, we ought to work together. I mean, you say safety is your number one concern. Here's some suggestions. And if it is, there should be nothing here that you don't want to do to protect your passengers. Well, he looked at me like, who is this guy, you know, that would say that? Well, a year later, it's interesting, there was another hearing in the House. And at that hearing, the cruise ships were ordered to meet with us and go through the 10-point program. And the theory was, what can we voluntarily work out, you know, to improve safety on cruise ships? So we're going to Washington at our expense and had this meeting. And the standard answer, Vinny, is these are great ideas. We'll look at them. We'll study them. We'll review them, but no commitments. So 6 months later, we have another hearing. And the question of Elijah Cummings, the chairman, what did you agree to? And we said, well, you know, we didn't agree to anything. You know, they just said, we'll look at it, we'll study it, you know. So at the end of that hearing in September of 2007, the chairman, Elijah Cummings, said something that totally caught him off guard. He said, look, hey, this is our fourth hearing on safety. Tell me, for the cruise lines, tell me, what are you willing to do? You know, what will you commit to? You got 90 days. Tell me. I want a report. 90 days later, they come back, I think December 19th of 2007. Big, slick, 32-page report. Guess what, Vinny? They agreed to nothing. You know, they said, oh, we're going to study it. We're going to review it. Great ideas. But they agreed to nothing. But they went one step further, Vinny. And it was
they went a step further than nothing.
Well, yeah, they said on the first, there was a three-page covering letter, and they said in the first page the FBI had testified at the earlier hearing that crime rate on cruise ships is 0.01%. That's like nothing. Then they put that on the headline of the next page, and they put it in the next page. They kept repeating that statement. Well, there was only one problem with that statement, Vinny. The FBI had never said that. And I went to him and I got this letter from the FBI. I said, we never said that. So then we go to a Senate hearing chaired by Senator John Kerry in June of 2008. And I brought this up. I said, my goodness, that takes chutzpah to say these things. And they're not true. And they brought to this hearing, Vinny, this is probably the highlight of everything, an expert to defend them. He wasn't on the panel, but he was there to defend their numbers. When I got done with that statement, he interrupted the hearing. He was in the audience and said to Senator Kerry, I want to say something. And he said, well, okay, I'll give you 30 seconds. His comment is, clearly, those statements were not true. I don't know how the cruise lines could have even used them. Here was their expert witness interrupting the hearing. You know, and for somebody that pays millions of dollars for lobbyists, I mean, the worst thing you do is lie to a congressional hearing. But they did that. So yeah. We eventually then, legislation was introduced by John Kerry in the Senate, Doris Matsui in the House. We eventually passed that bill between the House and the Senate, Vinny, with only 4 votes against it in 2010. This is against an industry that spent millions fighting us. But
you know what? You can pay somebody to do a job, but you can't pay them to care about the job.
Right, right. Well, it's been a struggle. I wish that was the end of the story, Vinny. But as we've gotten into the making the law effective, I don't know what it is in New Zealand. I can't speak about New Zealand. But in the United States, if you call the police and say, I've been robbed, it becomes a public record. And this information is all kept, whether they do anything or not. Well, the intention of this bill was that all alleged crimes have to be reported and posted on the Internet. Well, we'd gotten this information. There were hundreds of crimes in a given year. So the first quarter of last year, FBI comes and the Coast Guard come up with its report with only 7 crimes. I said, well, gee, this can't be right. Well, to make a long story short, I finally went to a reporter here in the United States. I said, hey, things aren't working here as intended by the law. So he went to John Kerry's office, and somebody had changed 7 words in the bill. So the bill, instead of reporting all of those crimes, said only those cases that have been closed by the FBI. Well, number one, the FBI might only open 10% of the files. If they don't close them, there are no crimes. And guess who he said made the change, Vinny? The FBI and the Coast Guard requested the change. Here's the very people are there to protect us, are protecting the cruise lines. It was incredible. So,
well, there's your answer to where their protective net in the enforcement game comes from. I thought it might have been CIA, but now it looks more like it might be FBI protection.
Well, they've been very successful, Vinny. They hired, cruise lines went in and hired the number 3 guy from the FBI. They hired the chief lobbyist from the FBI. They've hired these guys when they retire to go work for them. They've done the same with the Coast Guard, and they have built a relationship.
You know what? I think that relationship existed long before those FBI agents retired, and then when they do retire, they might get to pick their successor who will carry on the scam in their name, and they work an even nicer and tighter business relationship that where both of them can earn money by assisting criminals.
Yeah, well, I mean, and these
whilst guys, being at the FBI above reproach.
Well, somehow you think that, gee, the FBI, boy, they're on our side. They're here to protect us. The only people being protected are the cruise ships. But in March 1st of this year, Vinny, Senator Rockefeller held a Senate hearing. And he said to the cruise lines, you know, you use the services of 21 government agencies, the Coast Guard, the FBI, he didn't go through all the 21, but there are 21 agencies. And you pay no federal taxes. You're getting it for free. He says, do you think that's fair that you get all this and you pay nothing for it? And the response of the head of the cruise line, Christine Duffy, said, well, we just pay what we're legally required to pay in Panama and Liberia. So they pay no taxes. I mean, it's they're getting this, and they pay no taxes, you know, but it's being noticed in Washington. I mean, I don't know about New Zealand, but, you know, we got budget questions. And here's two major corporations, or all of them, have so structured themselves to avoid all taxes but freely use the services of the government agencies. I mean, that's a shame.
Yeah, kind of like an ungrateful child who eats everything in your fridge, uses all your hot water, and then skips out without paying a cent or cleaning up after themselves. We'll be right back after the break with Ken Carver.
I take my anger to a place that ain't gonna get up in your face. The facts we okay, but the system fails. We got to change the way we see.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the final segment that we've got here with my very special guest from internationalcruisevictims.org, the lovely Ken Carver. And I also want to give a shout out to my man Patrick, who sent me an email about 2 months ago, requesting that this interview be done. And in fact, it's almost exactly 2 months ago to the day. So we've had you in the waiting wings for some time, Ken, because you're all over the place. You're all getting in through the media. When do you take time off? Is that even possible in what you've done now? I mean, you've lost a daughter and things like that, and I've seen so many parents who lose a child who simply can't go back to normal life. There's no on and off anymore.
Well, I tell you, Vinny, you have a choice when you're faced with a cover up, and there's been all kinds of cover ups. You know, pedophiles, whatever it is, you have a choice. You can walk away from it, or you can say, hey, this is not right. I'm going to try and change it. Now, did I consciously know where this thing was going when I started off down this road? The answer is no. I was just looking for a daughter. And it's one of those things, the further I went, people start coming to us from around the world. You can't believe the stories I hear from people. And it's like getting on a horse. It just starts going faster and faster and faster. And Vinny, I got to be honest, it's 7 days a week. You know, last week, 42-year-old just disappeared. The family was calling me from the ship. What should we do? Well, when I started off, I didn't realize what to do. We had to work our way through it. But for people to have, if they're a victim of a crime, to be able to go to an organization where women have been raped, I just talked to one tonight, or every 2 weeks somebody goes missing on a cruise ship, Vinny. That's every 2 weeks. There's been 23 this year, and the year's not over with. And these people are frantic that this would happen. And they very seldom is there ever any video, no explanation. There could be all kinds of reasons. But there's a Professor Ross Klein who worked with this woman in Australia, and he runs a website which is on our homepage called Cruise Junkie. And he's a college professor, and he keeps track every time it makes the press someplace in the world of somebody going missing, he adds it to the list. Now, if it doesn't make the press, it's not added to the list. It just, you know, it doesn't happen. But more and more people are calling these things in from the ship that something's happened. So that
you can imagine with all the cover-up process and things of that nature that many people will simply give up when faced with this kind of thing, because they're in a huge state of grief at that point. So, well, so many of these things must go unreported, vastly more than have been reported, wouldn't you say?
Well, I'm absolutely convinced of that. Rape victims, women, under a Freedom of Information Act that I got for a year's alleged crimes, 18% were minors. They're young girls who are sexually attacked on a cruise ship, they don't even tell their parents for a couple of months. You know, and eventually it might come out that they've been traumatized by this. And so a lot of these rape things, they never say anything. You know, a woman is embarrassed. And I talked to one tonight just 10 minutes before we started this show. She was raped last year, 31 years old. And she's tried to get recourse and is given up. You know, and but she's willing to talk about it. So many of them are not willing to talk about it. So, I mean,
isn't that just a strange twist of fate that the people who are the victims of crime don't want to talk about it, and the people who are the perpetrators of the crime and are supposed to be responsible for correcting said things don't want to investigate it and don't want to actually bring anybody to justice?
Well, I have to say I agree with you. You know, take the FBI. Some woman's been raped on a cruise ship. They don't want to deal with it. It's a nuisance to them, you know. And so the poor woman is left. You know, if you got raped here in the country, you'd go to a hospital, say I've been raped. The police would come and make a report, and they would take action. Not always, but there's more chance on a cruise ship. Forget it. You know, you got the legal hurdles. I mean, the bill that we passed now gives any U.S. citizen who comes or leaves a U.S. port the right to call directly to the FBI. Otherwise, it's been filtered through the cruise line security to the FBI. And they know how to write these things. They said it's a he said, she said. So the FBI said, well, we're not going to deal with that. You know, that's a nuisance. There should be independent security on cruise ships. It is possible that that could be established. But in California, we tried to pass a bill where when it entered California water, a security officer would get on. The cruise line said, well, pull out of San Diego and San Francisco if you pass such a law. You know, it's blackmail, you know. But the tide has turned worldwide. And,
so to speak.
So to speak. We're not there yet. But if you said to the cruise lines, call up CLIA, their cruise line association, say, hey, I want to do a one-hour interview with you on safety issues on cruise ships, they wouldn't come, you know, because they can't defend their position. That's why when we got into four congressional hearings, they're in an indefensible position. The only thing they have is lots of money and skilled people, and they built relationships with certain legislators through donations, by hiring people that have worked for the FBI, the Coast Guard, been very effective at that, in working the political scene. But if they said, here, do a show on how you're protecting the passengers, they won't come on. If the announcer knows what he's doing, unless it's a travel show and he's selling cruise ships.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe you should do up a brochure, Ken, and advertising a particular cruise line and all the crimes that they might, if they're lucky, suffer whilst aboard.
Well, we do it.
You could get the full alcoholic rape package with a room with a porthole, so you can look out the sea while you're being disastrously sodomized or something of that nature. You know, really, really kind of hit it home to people that this is really what they're doing. They're selling these beautiful packages, but you're simply going to become a victim in some cases. You know?
If you do become a victim, nothing will happen to the person that's done the crime. I mean, that's the reality of it.
Just that simple. What about guns? I mean, are people allowed concealed carry on these cruise ships? Do they have any methodology of self-defense of that nature?
Not to my knowledge, Vinny. You know, and if I don't know, I won't say that they do or they don't. Not to my knowledge.
Might be a good idea to find out, because as far as I know, criminals prefer unarmed victims.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's an area that and I appreciate you're doing this show. The public of the world has to become aware of the issue. You know, and it started off with just a few of us, but the word is spreading. Victim Support of Europe which is the umbrella organization for all victims groups in Europe, has now made us a member, an associate member. We're the only group outside of Europe that's a member, and they're working with us to put laws in place in the country. The World Society of Victimology, which is the top victim group in the world, asked us to do a presentation in The Hague in May of this year. And they have officially said, we're going to support you to protect victims of crimes. I mean, if crime occurs, I mean, if you had a city and nobody was arrested for crimes, rapes, or whatever, people, the UN would hold a meeting on it. And yet that's going on in cruise ships.
Yeah. Well, it's like a cruise ship philosophy. If a woman screams, I'm being raped on a cruise ship, and nobody wants to investigate it, did she really get raped?
Yeah. Well, it's an easy defense. They say, well, it's he said, she said, or I mean, it just...
That's happened to me in personal relationships. I mean, it's just, you get assaulted, and then you call the police, and then the person who assaulted you lies and says that they didn't. And then the police say, oh, it's he says, she says.
Yeah. Well, that's they know how to beat this stuff. And if they do prove it, you know, it's impossible to get justice. That was the call I had 15 minutes before we did this radio show tonight. The woman says, hey, I couldn't get justice. And she's willing to go public. So we are putting her in contact with a national magazine. We do get these phenomenal stories because people need to know that if they're entering a world that has got major problems.
It's got huge problems, massive problems, problems the size of an ocean-going cruise liner with 18 decks and unlimited alcohol. Kendall Carver from internationalcruisevictims.org. Thank you very much. And you can check out his website, ladies and gentlemen, and get any videos, testimonies. He's doing a heck of a lot of interviews, 7 days a week for the poor guy. If you can support him in any way, shape, or form, please do. Ken, thank you so much, man. It's been a pleasure.
Well, our pleasure, Ben.
All right. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in, opening your eyes, opening your ears, and opening your hearts to the real truth, whatever the hell horrible it may be. And we'll see you again sometime.